Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 13th, 2014. Welcome to episode 72 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Find my way back to Oz. Will I ever find my way back?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and stuff. We like to talk about stuff. We get together every couple weeks. It is kind of a reunion here, the four of us. We're finally back together here. We're still missing Dr. Steve, but he promises pretty soon. So, you know, we'll get him on here eventually. So, hey, how are you guys doing? I should mention, I'm Earl. I'm in Portland, Oregon. And it's sunny today, despite the fact that it's Portland, Oregon. So, Michael, what's going on in your neck of the woods?
Down here in Sydney town, school holidays have started. Driving into the office this morning was a little bit more chaotic as family holiday goers were careening across the roads in various directions trying to get out of the city. But retro computer wise, it's been a drought. Haven't had a chance to play with any of my toys.
Yeah, time has been rough on me, too. I'll talk about that in the closing thing. Something that I'm a little extracurricular thing here is sucking up all my time. But speaking of all your time being sucked up, Carrington, what's going on, busy guy?
Awesome.
Well, yeah, that's just a state of being.
Although I'm not, unfortunately, at the moment. I was not supposed to be on this show. I wasn't supposed to be at work today. And I was supposed to be at the Midwest Gaming Classic, but alas, a thing came up that trapped me in Toronto, so I'm imposing myself on you guys instead.
What, the mayor's going to put up the road barricades?
Exactly. The border's getting tougher and tougher for me to get over.
Well, sorry you couldn't go to that event.
Me too. Carrington. I was looking forward to it. But alas, there's always next year.
Yeah. Yeah, and Paul, how are you?
No, I'm doing well. The spring has come, I think, pretty much here, which is good, although it doesn't make me want to stay in and play with computers, but that's all right. I'll do it anyway.
Yes, it gets harder in Portland, too. It's almost like a flower blooming every year. When the sun starts to come out, you see all the Portlandians emerging from their caves, from our rain caves, and
that one day where it doesn't rain.
Exactly, yeah. Somebody says, when is summer in Portland? And I said, well, last year it was on a Thursday. So anyway, it's April 13th. Luckily, it's not Friday the 13th. It's Sunday the 13th, and we're going to talk about, speaking of retro computers, because we often speak of them, what do we do with them? This is something that we talked about in the last few episodes, and people sent us their comments, which we appreciate very much. We won't get to mention all of them here, but I did read all of them. I appreciated them, and it was kind of fascinating to take a survey of what's going on with retro computers. One of our listeners had said, hey, I'd love it if you ask, what do people do with these things? Because I just wind up collecting them, and unfortunately, they sit around too much. So here's some things that people do with them. Gaming, that's not a surprise, right? Everybody does gaming on their retro computers, the games of ye old. I just, by the way, I'm going to do an online review of this, but I just got done reading the book Vintage Gaming Consoles. And that was a great book, and it included a number of computers as well as... Any of you guys read that book yet by Bill LoJudas and Matt Barton?
I have not.
Vintage Game Consoles. It's a great book. So, anyway... learn it, live it, love it. So gaming, people do that. Programming. In fact, one of the respondents had said, after programming modern computers all day with their complexities and frustrations and that, it's actually really fun to go back to a 6502 or one of the early simple systems and crank out some code on that. It's like a breath of fresh air. And people do this two ways. Some people crank out code on the old bits. They don't do this newfangled cross-development stuff, but other people like using things like CC65 and other cross-development tools. So, and then collection and restoration, big deal with folks. Anders wrote in, he's restoring a PDP-8 from 1969, which makes me unbelievably all kinds of jealous. And he collects a number of systems, including Swedish computers, which I've never even seen pictures of, like Luxor systems. Have you guys ever seen those?
No,
anyone?
No, I have.
Nope.
Yeah,
nope.
This is so fascinating. And Michael wrote in, he mentioned similar thing. He just likes to get stuff working. Once it's working, it just kind of sits. It's like, fix it up, and then, ooh, that's nice, on to the next project. Electronic interfacing, the old systems were easy to hook up with. And they were so easy, in fact, that people make modern-day peripherals for him using that kind of techniques. Rocky does koala paintings, which I thought was awesome, and they looked really cool. Themo opened up, and please forgive me if I'm mispronouncing your name. It's T-H-I-E-M-O, but he opened up the Oldenburger Computer Museum. And there's a Facebook page that we'll link to. He said after he got done collecting all these things and he looked around, he's like, this is just boring having them all to myself. So he started a charity and opened up a museum. And Jeff likes to learn firsthand about the history. You know, you actually get it out and play with it. He says you can't really do modern day stuff on them. It's not like you're going to use them for productivity, but you can learn a lot from them. So that's what people do. So let me go around the table here. I'll start with you, Carrington. What do you think about all this?
Never used a retro computer. I'm on the wrong show. I thought it was a different class, sir.
You're supposed to be on that no quarter. Now, I did say all those who aren't flying to Seattle should deplane at this time.
Whoops. I use mine, unsurprisingly, my main use for retro computers is gaming. Lots and lots and lots of gaming. I love gaming, and I like it on the real iron, and I like to get real still sealed software that I rip open and I play. That's like my favorite thing is I like to ruin the collectability of rare games. So that's what mostly I do is I wreck other people's fun. So unsurprisingly. And then other than that, it's typically individual small projects. Like, for instance, at the moment, what I've been doing is I have an Apple IIe at my front door that displays direct message Twitter things and any tweets by certain people. So when I come home, I can see those. And it's been cobbled together through a few different things, and it's been hard to get that working. But now it does that. And so that's been fun. And so a lot of times it's little things like that where I just decide, I have a little project and it feels retro or it feels more fun to try to throw old hardware at it. And so that's what I do. But my real answer is mostly I do a lot of gaming.
Yep. And that fits in with most of the responses that we got. Paul, once again, I come to you second here. I guess you're the middle child today. So what do you think about this? What do you do? I know you do a bunch of stuff with your retro computers, including some fixing, as I recall.
Yeah, I guess what I have is a problem with the – I think my parents would have called it my eyes are too big for my stomach or something like this, where I see a lot of things that look like they would be interesting projects, and what they end up being is, big piles of to-do lists. But what I probably mostly do at the moment is getting things running and then using them to sort of back up software that I have for it. Where there are, or just see it running, that sort of thing. I have a lot of ideas about what I'd like to do, and many more, many computers to try to get running. There are a couple things that I have that are really sort of obscure that I would like to try to make go. I have this thing called a Jupiter 2, a WaveMate Jupiter 2, which is, you know, it's a computer with a couple of 8-inch drives, and it's I'm actually not quite sure even what processor it runs, it's got a front plate and it really is, you know, it's really quite, it's S100 looking, but I don't think it is an S100 computer. It's I'm not sure what the processor is. I think it might be 6800. That's one of the sort of the semi-restoration type things I would like to do and have not done. I know I've basically just set it up, took a picture, you know, done some research on the web, found little, and I guess I use a lot of emulators, actually. That's what I tend to, you know, when I'm just sort of quickly want to see how something works, you know, I'll fire up the emulator and then, just sort of look at the real machine sitting next to me.
So having all these to-do lists, as you call them, does it cause you any free-floating anxiety?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, the hobby is supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be stressful. So I got to figure a way around that. Now, I will mention that, and this isn't technically doing something with the retro computer, but it's a tangent of that, that you archive magazines and that sort of thing, and, you know, preserve some of the history of that. You've done that kind of thing, and I think that's a very valuable thing to do in retro computing. I suppose that's not actually sitting down and doing something with the retro computer, but it's still good stuff.
Yes, it's definitely very interesting to be able to see what was happening at the time, and magazines are a really good source too of just kind of like, I don't know, just sort of seeing what the feeling was about the computers and how they were advancing, and, you know, what was new and exciting and so forth. And a lot of these things haven't been archived, you know, so it is good to sort of get them scanned and make them available, and it's quite fun to read them.
Yeah, the cost of stuff, only $24.95 for a 10 megabyte hard drive. What a deal. So, Michael, you're building the 8-bit bunker. So, definitely, you must do some things with retro computers.
Yes. Well, I think I have a to-do list of to-do lists. So, my 8-bit bunker is coming along fine. And what I'm intending to do down there is set up a soldering station, extractor and everything, so that I can get in and attempt to fix a few machines and try not to blow them up or me in the process. That magic smoke has to be kept where it belongs. As well as tinkering, I also go after what I consider my iconic computers of my younger days. So I've got a, not quite in the same retro feel, but Bondi Blue iMac that first came out, the Cube, and a few other bits and pieces. I get them up and running and use those. My Apple II, as Carrington says, it's nothing like playing a game on the real deal. Even though I do use emulators, I like firing that up and having the occasional game of Carriers at War or any of the other SSG games. And the project which I have started and unfortunately stalled on due to painting the main part of the house is the VZ200. So that's made it out of its shipping package and is now on the desk and just looking for a suitable power supply to hook it up. Then I'll start tinkering with that one. But games and more games, I think, is the best way to sum it up.
Yep. We all like playing the games, and, you know, I'm not a big hardcore retro gamer, but I do like me some Jumpman or some Frogger or Asteroids or just some of those old classics. I can just sit there for a long time and play those. And, you know, one thing that Jeff mentioned in his email to us that I thought was interesting, he doesn't think a whole lot about this question, what he does with the retro computers, because to him, it's a thinly veiled attempt at justification. And I think he's right. It's kind of like, it's just fun to have these things, and I'm not going to sit around fretting about trying to justify the fact that I like to have them. I don't. Maybe it's the intangible essence of having them that is a big part of this. So,
for me as well, there is a real beauty to older hardware, I find. It's something that really appeals to me aesthetically. And I think in the same way that people will collect classic cars that they can't necessarily do a lot of driving in, but that they are appreciating for the aesthetics of you know, they're still appreciated as a mechanical thing, as a functional device, but also for their inherent beauty and the nostalgia of remembering when they were new and all of that. And I think that all comes into play with retro computing collectors as well.
I totally buy that. I mean, I have my pet set up on the desk down here in the daylight basement that we have. And I come down the stairs and I see it, and it just looks good sitting there. Now, if it didn't work, I wouldn't be nearly as interested in it. I wouldn't want it just for the museum piece or the aesthetic value. But that kind of squared off, strange 2001 inspired sort of, you know, form factor of the pet, you just don't see that in anything anymore.
Exactly. So I think the real point I'm making is us computer guys, we're cool like car guys.
I think we are.
I think it's indisputable.
Maybe even cooler.
And that's why they should stop beating us up, is the point that I'm trying to make most. Really.
Thank you. Thank you. Finally, someone has the guts to call it out.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I think we beat that topic to death, but thank you, everybody, for sending us your responses. And I'm glad that people are doing things with retro computers out there and just enjoying them. And just always love to hear that. So we've got some news stories, and Michael, we'll start with you. Apparently, a Kickstarter has succeeded.
Yes, shock, horror, gasp. Back in episode 70, I brought up that there was a Commodore 64, the Visual Compendium, that was being proposed, and they were saying April 1 for the Kickstarter. Well, if you go over to the Kickstarter project now, they're at £21,000 and change. It looks like it's definitely going to be a goer. So you've got 17 days to go. They are up to 499 backers, I'm going to make it 500.
Nice. Looking forward to some beautiful imagery out of this. Mm-hmm. I think it should be very cool. Yeah, and we'll have a link for that up in the show notes. I'm excited to see that. Although, again, since it seemed like it was going to be somewhat game-focused, and since I wasn't a huge gamer, even on the Commodore 64, I don't know if all of those things will resonate with me, but I think it's still going to be beautiful to look at. Carrington, what have you got for us on the National Museum of Computing?
Well, even though, like I said, I don't use retro computers and I've found myself somehow in the wrong podcast, I'm gonna dive ahead and pretend. And so the Bletchley Park Maze was a maze that existed over in Bletchley Park, thus its name, up to World War II. And then I think it got removed, it got paved over, turned into tennis courts or something, and now it's been gone for quite some time. Well, the National Museum of Computing has an event going on right now, which is the Easter Bytes Festival. So running from, started on April 10th, it's going to run through the 21st, so lots of time to get over there if you want. And part of it, the whole festival sounds interesting, and you can build Lego Mindstorm things and learn about old computers, and all sounds like the usual National Museum of Computing fun. But the thing that really caught my eye is they have digitally recreated the Bletchley Park maze. So you can sit down at a computer, and you're just basically going to use your keyboard to go walking through the maze. And to get an experience for, like, well, what was the maze like? It was called a turning maze. And when you go through the digital version of the maze, they have hung up little clues, little Easter eggs. And each Easter egg will give you three letters. And the three letters are part of a cipher. So you have to make your way all the way through the maze and collect all the little bits of the cipher. Then if you can decode the cipher, you get a little prize. Now, I think it's a Caesar cipher, so it's not going to be particularly difficult to decode. But this is aimed at kids, and it sounds like super fun. So I think anybody in the UK who has children into computers, into mazes, into solving things, I think you should head over. So sounds super fun. So it's just 5 pounds. Looks like a really fun event going on.
Making history fun. We love our folks at the National Museum of Computing, don't we? Those folks rock.
And I want to throw in another quick link as well that's sort of related. In Minecraft, a fellow has put together a Turing quiz maze. So it's the Bletchley Park maze, sort of. It's more like inspired by the grounds of Bletchley Park. And it's in Minecraft. So if you're a fan of Minecraft, you can go through this little maze. There's a nice YouTube video of somebody doing a walkthrough. So if you don't have Minecraft, you don't have access, but you just want to see it, it's fun to watch this. So it has a little guy going through his 8-bit maze, and in the maze, it'll come to signs, and it gives you a quiz on Turing. And it'll say, like, during World War II, Turing invented the following machine, and it will give you two options. And if you think it's option one, you go to the left. If you think it's option two, you go to the right. And if you go the wrong, it leads you to a dead end that says, nope, try the other way. And so you can't really go wrong that long, but it's neat, and it uses cool elements to show you how to put together not gates, and it looks really, really fun. So if you're interested in mazes as well, that's a quick little video you can check out.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have some great links in the show notes this time around, aren't we?
We are.
Folks are going to have to come over to rcrpodcast.com this time, because you want the bonus material on this DVD, baby. So I'm going to talk about some feedback we got from Michael on episode 70. And this was about the discussion of Tanktix, which is an early board computer game hybrid that was designed by Chris Crawford. So apparently in the episode there was some confusion about whether this Chris Crawford is the Chris Crawford, and the answer is yes. So if you're not in the Atari 8-bit community, you could be forgiven by not immediately recognizing his name, because after programming Eastern Front 1941, which was a really big deal, essentially as a homebrew game, he was hired by Atari and worked solely on Atari titles until their demise. And I'm not sure exactly what that means in terms of their demise, because Atari as a brand bounced around for a bit.
But I think it's like original Atari, which has been gone for some time.
The original, like, 8-bit system demise?
The original owners.
Perhaps? Yeah. So, Michael continues, for the early Macintosh, he created Balance of Power, Patton versus Rommel, and Trust and Betrayal, in case those titles ring any bells. And I'm curious, since you like the strategy games, Michael, if you ever bumped into any of those for the early Mac.
Well, I last year picked up Patton versus Rommel, just because I wanted to get some of the earlier Macintosh games to help flesh out my thinly veiled excuse for collecting the original Macintosh. Balance of Power I'm familiar with. A lot of the games, I'm familiar with the game, not the authors, I suppose. So I suppose that's an element of slackness on my part. But with Michael having sent in this email, some of that is starting to ring some bells for me.
Nice. And he also points out that Chris Crawford was a co-author of Day Ray Atari, which in the Atari 8-bit realm is one of the most famous books and one of the most well-regarded in terms of its expository powers of imparting super cool Atari 8-bit secrets to you. And there's an Amazon link for that. Michael also points out, also there was some discussion about how Tanktix is unplayable without the game board and counters. However, there's a modern program called Vassal that enables traditional board games to be played on the computer, enabling play by email or play over network for traditional tabletop board games. He mentions a couple months ago he purchased a still sealed copy of Tanktix for the purpose of creating a Vassal module, but he found out somebody else had done it already. So it's possible to run the Tanktix program on your vintage micro alongside a laptop running the Vassal module for the game, and we'll have some links to that in the show notes as well. And this sounds like a really interesting thing. I have never heard of this Vassal engine. Is this news to you folks as well?
Or yep, and I have immediately run off, as I see from other people. I've run off to the website. I see other people in our show notes are doing the same thing.
Yes, I've known about this website for 10 seconds now.
The open source board game engine. Well, this appeals to me greatly.
That is really cool.
Yep. And trust me, it's now just gone and hit my bookmarks on my laptop here.
I'd be downloading it now if it weren't risking kind of disrupting the Skype call.
I am actually downloading it now. Screw your call. I want this.
So apparently, you've intrigued the hosts.
Yes.
I'm sure. Also the
okay,
listeners.
Okay, can we just get the audience to press pause and give us an hour or two?
And play some games with us. I'm a huge fan of tabletop games. So.
Do we have any retro computing movies they could watch while we play this?
Pirates of Silicon Valley. If they haven't seen it, you got to go watch that while we do this. So, Michael also concludes with thanks for all the podcasts. And Michael, thank you for this information. Mm-hmm. Very informative.
Well, from Michael to Michael, thank you.
And Paul, Apple II archaeology project, what's going on here?
Well, this is actually something that's just been happening, I think over the last day or two. So Michael J. and actually I don't know how to pronounce his name. Michael J. Mann, maybe M-A-H-O-N, is a longtime member of the Apple II community and has collected many things. But recently he decided to sort of like donate it to the community. So he's opened up his storage space, and some people from I don't know exactly how they were chosen. I think of them as being sort of part of the Kansas Fest committee, but it's Stavros Karatsord Carrington. How do you say his name?
Stavros.
Stavros, Stavros, and Tony Diaz and Sean Fay are down, sort of cataloging everything that was in his storage space and posting pictures of what they're finding on Facebook, and it's an interesting it's actually very interesting first of all to see all these things because the collection is tremendous. I mean, there are things, many things in their boxes and so forth. But the other thing that's really nice about this is that it's not an estate sale find or anything like that. I mean, like, Michael Mann's there to he's not, I don't know if he's physically there, but he's at least able to sort of like say, what these things are and, what to expect in these boxes and things like that. So it's really interesting just sort of following it. There's a huge thread on the Facebook Apple II enthusiasts group that's, I think right now it's got 173 comments on it, many of which are pictures of the things that they're finding.
As a lot of people, if you've been to Kansas Fest before, you'll know that Sean frequently will show up with sometimes a busload of things that the community has brought together, and it becomes a big garage sale, and lots of things get donated, some things get sold, and it's a way to distribute things in the community. So it couldn't be in better hands than having Sean involved. If you want to have things stay in the community and have somebody really know what they're doing and really guard it well and not be in it to try to make a bunch of money, but instead to find the correct homes for items into, people who will love it into their hands. Sean is the guy to do that. So I'm just delighted that he is heading this up.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. I think, and they are, they're definitely trying to, document, image. I think today there was some rain, so they're spending a lot of time imaging discs and they're going to be scanning things. And I think some of the stuff is going to become available at the next couple Kansas Fests. So that's another motivation to go and another motivation to drive.
I think you said they're going to sell a couple of things to try to recoup costs, and then the majority will do things like at Kansas Fest or try to find a way to keep it in the community.
Yeah. No, it's really quite exciting. I'm very interested to see some of the stuff this summer.
Yeah, I've been following the photos on this one, and it's definitely drill worthy. I'd have to get myself a tunnel excavating machine or a battalion of dwarves to extend back into the sandstone.
You don't
of my
have a battalion
bunker.
Of dwarves?
No.
Oh,
no.
That's early level stuff, man.
all those lovely boxed bits and pieces there. I just would love to go and get lost in the depths of that horde.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to really have any of it myself. Like, I'm not a collector, so the last thing I would want is massive numbers of Rubbermaid bins of old things. I would just end up wrecking them or what have you. But I love that they get saved, and I love that they exist, and I like to occasionally get to see them. So for me, like, if this sort of material comes to Kansas Fest and just lets me hang out with it for a few days, that's enough for me. That's all I really want. So I'm very excited about it.
These photos are amazing. This is great. All right. Oh, yeah. That's right. I got to host the show and stuff. Okay. All right. Well, we're going to... people should check that out. And again, we will have a link. So we'll add that to the litany, the pantheon of links for this particular episode. So, Michael, once again, you take us toward the C64. I'm really starting to like you there, man.
I'm gonna have to get myself some serious help here. For an Apple II guy, I am getting lost in the wonders of the Commodore 64 world. So, but then again, it's more the fact that I like reading. So follow the link across to the Reset magazine. First issue was out in end of November last year. Second issue is available now, and they say that they're working on issue 3, which will be out in May, which is not that long to wait. And it's quite an interesting set of PDFs. Nice little website, nothing too pretentious, yeah, it is some good reading, some good writing, and I'm really looking forward to episode 3. So even if you're not in the Commodore world, pop over, have a read, a little bit of interest in the other retro machines, and I think I might have to start looking for some Apple stuff for a change.
Well, this is great. So this is then not just one, but two online Commodore magazines, because you've got Commodore Free as well that comes out on a regular basis. So very, very nice. Thank you for finding that. And Carrington, top that.
I can top that, because rather than focusing on one computer, I'm going to focus on all of the computers, a little later than I usually look at. But I stumbled across this really neat thing, which is the Graphic User Interface Gallery. It's just a little website, and the website that has been updated quite recently, but has the appearance of one of those websites that hasn't been updated for a long time, but which is totally suitable for what it is. It even has one of those IE is evil buttons that was going around quite a few years ago. So what this is just a collection of screenshots to give you a sense of what was happening with various GUIs. So for instance, Amiga OS. And so you can go on this website and look at Amiga Workbench 1.whatever, 2.whatever. And what's fun is, like, the screenshots are clickable, so you can open them full size. And full size for these old operating systems is quite a small window on a modern window.
You might have to zoom your browser.
Totally. So that's mostly what I get struck by. I will open up, like, say, DeskView X and think, it's so tiny. You can say span it out. And it's just fun to look at a bunch of things that I hadn't seen for a while, to be able to look at the Xerox Alto operating system, to be able to look at OS 2, because I had remembered OS 2 Warp, playing with it very little, and thinking, my main impression was, it was hideous, like the color choices. I was just like, what's going on? So I got to go back and look at it and think, yes, I was correct. What was going on? What were they thinking with these aquas and purples? But, you know, it's something of its time. Anyway, it's fun to look at. You can sort of dive in and look at things. And it's, you know, just a super fun little collection of screenshots of various GUIs from lots of different computers.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I've come across this site before. Just, you know, Google has sent me to one screenshot or another in here, but I haven't really explored it, and it is neat to have them all collected together like this.
It reminded me of some things that I had basically forgotten about, like At Ease. I don't know if you're a longtime Mac user, you'll remember there was a front end that was kind of for kids, kind of simplified, is more to, like, let's hide the user from even more stuff than Macintosh normally does. And it was the At Ease front end, which basically just gave you a couple of folders and big buttons, and that's all you got. I had forgotten even about that at all. So it's fun to look at the pictures of that, just to sort of go walking through the years.
Huh. It looks like that. I have bumped into this website over time myself.
Okay, everyone knew about it, but me, whatever.
No, I think that they have updated it also, and this GUI timeline is also really cool to take you through like a tour de force of GUIs over the years. And over time, they wind up looking less and less GUI, as it were. Ah, yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, I popped over through. And found that quite a few of those links were already traveled by my browser. And yeah, I think I must have come across some of the Geos ones and the Desk View just through other Google searches and just gone straight into it. But yeah, it's definitely worth a coffee break, this one.
And Gem Desktop was actually pretty cool. We used that quite a bit back in the day before Windows really took off. Just looking at this reminds me of that. All right, so on to the next thing. We've got some shows coming up. And the first one that we want to mention is the Vintage Computer Festival Southeast. And this is their 2.0. It's going to be on the 3rd and 4th of May. So it's coming right up. You should get your tickets now. So I'm going to read the little blurb that we got. Our alumni, David, of course, involved in this. And thank you very much, David, for bringing this to our attention. So let me read this. The Atlanta Historical Computer Society and the Computer Museum of America, which sounds so official, the Computer Museum of America, are pleased to announce the second annual Vintage Computer Festival Southeast. The venue will be the same CompUSA store building in Roswell, Georgia, as last year. But this year's exhibit space will be greatly enlarged, occupying the store's entire retail space. About two-thirds of the space will be occupied by a museum display of personal computing artifacts from the Kenback 1 forward. Kenback 1, as folks will recall, many regard that to be the first personal computer. So now that I've thrown out that little controversial blurb, I'll continue. The remaining one-third of the retail space will contain hobbyist vintage computing exhibits. For those who missed last year or would like to see it again, the Apple Pop-Up Museum will pop up again. And the popular retro gaming area and introduction to soldering activity will be available again. This year, we're also working to bring in a number of vendors, assemble a stellar slate of speakers, and offer workshop experiences. And of course, the kids' scavenger hunt will be back this year, too. The admission's $10 a person, children 17 and younger, admitted free of charge. Parking is free. The 3rd of May, Saturday, it's 10 to 7. The 4th of May, Sunday, it's 10 to 5. And that's it. Be there or be square.
I think at some point in a future show, we should discuss the idea of whether or not the Kenback 1 is the first person computer. Because I would like to take the contrary side on that and say, what? No.
Whatever. A surprise, Carrington.
Whatever.
You being a contrarian? Let's also talk about the Cocoa Fest, shall we? This is the 23rd annual last Chicago Cocoa Fest. They call each one the last one because they never know when it really might be the last one, which I honestly feel is a glasses half empty kind of approach. But this is the 2014 version. The theme is Wheel of Fortune. Before and after 8-bit ad with Carrie is turned on. And I don't know what that means, but it's going to be great. It's Saturday, the 26th of April. So just 13 days from now, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., there'll be a Saturday evening social, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., and it's also Sunday, the 27th of April, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's at the Heron Point Building, which is next to the Fairfield Inn and Suites in the basement lower level. And here's the address, 665 West North Avenue, Lombard, Illinois, 60148. And we'll have some information on this in the show notes. And what is it? Well, the Cocoa Fest is a festival centered around the Radio Shack Color Computer and other 6809-based hardware and operating systems. But other 8-bit computers and operating systems are welcome, too. So, you know, bring them if you got them. The festival is hosted by the Glenside Color Computer Club, Inc., and admission for the 2-day event is $5. So that's actually cheaper than the $10 for the Vintage Computer Festival. So, you know, if you're value shopping, Anyway, parking is free, and you can.
I think
find...
there's a bit of a commute between the two, isn't there?
It is just a little bit, and we'll have some links up in the show notes about the main CocoFest site, how to get a booth, newsletters, that kind of thing.
Since I didn't get to go to the Chicago area this weekend to go to a retro event, I am strongly considering going to CocoFest because it's in 2 weeks. If I can just get the weekend free, then I will head down. I love the Coco. I owned one. I have always been a fan of everything other than its keyboard and that terrible joystick I had. But other than that, I find it endearing. So I would love to go to a CocoFest.
Really neat computer, and I think underrated historically, mm-hmm. in terms of not just its significance, but I mean the 6809 was a punchy little chip too. It was a brawler.
When you put it that way, it's a punchy little chip. It's like such a little backhanded compliment.
It's a good little chip, you know, pat on head, sport.
Man, I like the Coco. I'll defend the Coco over a 10-back-1. Yeah, I'm not letting that go. Anything with TTL chips does not count as a first personal computer, but whatever.
Okay.
That's for another episode.
And finally, there's this thing called Kansas Fest. And it opened for registration. And Kansas Fest, amazingly cool. If you haven't been, you should drop everything you're doing right now and go over and register, book your plane tickets, because, man, what a great few days hanging out in a dorm with geeks. Just great. And, again, the registration just opened in Carrington. I think you said you registered already.
I did indeed. I rushed off and registered. So I am all registered, and I cannot wait to go. Fantastic.
Very, very cool. And that's it for shows. So, we got a couple more news things here, and then we can get on to our retro gift thing. Paul, what have you got here?
Well, so I guess there probably is enough non-Apple stuff for me to bring this back around, and this might actually count as non-Apple anyway. But there was fairly recently on eBay, there was an auction for something called a Clearlight Superstar, and I'm just digging through my browser windows trying to find it again. Here it is. So this is a machine that I've I find it sort of interesting in a way. The Apple II Plus had a couple of there was a sort of a major not exactly a clone but a co-branding Apple II Plus which was made by Bell and Howell, and that was a black one.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people saw those in their schools and things. This was the first one I used as well. There's this other one called the Clearlight Superstar, which is allegedly also a co-branded Apple II Plus. And so it's painted gray. It's like it essentially, I think, the manufacturer of it was done as follows. They bought an Apple II Plus, and then they painted it gray, and they changed the badges.
I see.
So it's a little strange. It was essentially a custom-built system run in order to run multiple slide projectors in sort of like rapid sequence, you know, rapid accurate sequence. So it, I think it was primarily used in things like church religious presentations and things like this. I imagine that has something to do with the actual naming of this thing as well. But there are these gray machines with a Clearlight Superstar Apple Computer Inc. badge on them, and they have similar gray painted disk drives and so forth. And there are very, very few of these. I mean, you know, like they're almost sort of like legendarily non-existent. But one fairly complete system was found in, I think it was, you know, pretty much a church back storage room, and put on eBay. And it just ended like about a week ago, and it sold for $4,300.
Wow.
$4,338, which is unbelievable. Because this thing is, partly I have very mixed feelings about this, because it is super rare. It has the Apple logo right on it. And yet I am not quite sure to what extent I believe this is an Apple product, you know, like, so those, the Apple collectors might want it. Apparently somebody did.
But somebody wanted it $4,300 worth.
Somebody wanted just slightly less than that.
Right. The, I mean, one of the things that I think is actually kind of interesting. So I saw pieces of this computer before. There was, I think, maybe a year ago, one of the disk drives, not of this exact one, came up. And so I researched.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Yeah, selling for not that much. I remember even the drive sold for $120 or something.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was all by itself. And, you know, I hadn't heard of this thing at the time. And so I did a little bit of research into it. And it seems like basically the guy who started the company which produced these things, the Clearlight, they were basically like a projection sequencing company, but this was the machine they used to do it. So the guy's name is Eric Anderson, and he produced this, and there's a website that was updated, like, might have been like 10 years ago or something like that, which, you know, talks about his biography. And among the things that he did was this, and he actually went on to work at Apple for a while working. I think the main thing was it's on video stuff. So the video overlay card that the Apple II GS had, which allowed you to sort of overlay images on graphics and images on video and things. So he was responsible for that, and he has almost the only blurb available on the entire net about this computer, and he claims that he had a deal with Apple to do this co-branding, and eventually they decided to cut him off and say, no, stop making these. But anyway, I thought it was interesting. It's interesting to see. I really don't know what I feel about it, and I sort of feel like this is a really rare, interesting thing to have, and on the other hand, I feel like this is something, you know, somebody just bought and painted an Apple II Plus.
I remember when the individual drive sold, that also was what introduced me to the Clearlight Superstar. I had never heard of it before. So when that sold a while ago on eBay, I went off looking for info about what is this other Apple II computer that I'd never heard of that wasn't some, you know, thing only sold in certain areas of Bulgaria. This was something sold in America. I'm like, how can I have never heard of this before? So in reading about it, I also stumbled across Eric Anderson's blog or bio page that sort of talks about this. And he's really vague about the nature of that relationship. But it seems to imply that they had an agreement that they were allowed to produce or retrofit or whatever Apple II Pluses, brand them their own name, and sell them. And my first thought was, what's the nature of that agreement, and did it actually have an expiry date? Because if not, I'm thinking that's what you want, if you want to buy up that company or buy up that agreement and say, well, now I have the right to produce these ROMs. I have the right to send them out. Screw you, Apple. The Clearlight Superstar is back and it's on eBay, and I'm selling something with the ROMs built in. Or just an emulator. Like, have you had this agreement? You could maybe say it counts as an emulator thing. I don't know. But I'd love to know what was sort of the legal position there. And but it's so vague, like, who knows? Because it seems an odd production. Like, I agree that it does look like they were just taking existing computers and badging them. But I don't know. I immediately thought, yes, ROMs, legal ROMs. I love it.
There's one other comment I wanted to make about this, I guess, was that the thing that interests me probably more than anything about this setup is the software that he wrote for it. So he wrote an interesting sort of paging DOS that could do it was pretty much multi-threading as far as he describes it in order to run all of these simultaneous timelines on all these different projectors. And it would be really interesting to see the software. I don't care as much about the hardware, but you know, that is equally impossible to find.
I agree. Because the way he describes the software, exactly, if I recall, it was threaded, and you could run four threads at once or something. So one would be keeping time with music, and then you'd have three threads controlling individual projectors, and so that you're doing this three-projector presentation with music. And it sounds really interesting, especially for the time. So I also would love to get a copy of that code.
So someday someone will find it, perhaps. I think I have a couple of times attempted to email the, you know, Eric Anderson guy, and I think I just can't find he's hard to locate, basically. It's either he hasn't answered me or the email went off into the, you know, the black hole, which
he is also threaded, so it's difficult to get his attention.
Right.
Yeah, you need to find his NMI, you know, his non-massive interrupt, and then you can Huh, interesting. The esoteric edges of the Apple II, I guess you'd call it the OEM world.
Yeah. So we'll have links to all the stuff that we were just talking about, though, in the show notes as well. So if you're interested in this, and I was, first time I heard about it, I was like, what? The Clearlight Superstar? What the heck is that? So if you're interested in weird and esoteric co-branded Apple IIs, and you should be, then head over to rcrpodcast.com and you can check it out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so we've got one other spare news item, and I'm going to propose we talk about it in the next show.
Ooh.
Because we can get like a two-for-one. The news item is that the IBM System 360 turns 50, and the System 360's contribution to the computer world is incalculable.
Oh, I thought you were going with overrated.
No, no.
It'd take a mainframe to work it out.
Nicely done. I see what you did there. So, yes, we definitely want to talk about that. But also, you guys may know, BASIC is about to turn 50. And so, next episode, let's talk about a couple of extreme milestones in the computer world turning 50. We can talk about them together.
Yes, so did I.
I'm also extremely, I don't even know what adjective I'd use for my feelings about this to know that I'm older than both BASIC and the System 360 computer, but we won't dwell on that.
I'm younger, but that's only because I've scrolled over.
That's right.
Like humans, computers have memories. Unlike humans, their memories shrink when they work. Functions like color, sound, and movement use up large amounts of memory, leaving little for you to use. The new Auric Atmos, however, takes these functions in its stride, leaving lots of memory.
Hello?
So you can expand into advanced programming and sophisticated games. The new Auric Atmos 48K, the large memory that stays large.
And now let's talk about a gift. What can you buy someone that you really care about? Well, I contend that for that geek in your life that you want to be both intelligent and fashionable, you should get them Commodore 64 socks. And I think, you know, they're a hit at parties, and they're wonderful, and they're only $12. And they're available in multiple sizes. If you're small, you get the Dig Dug size, or medium is the Jumpman, large is the Spy Hunter, and extra large, of course, the Donkey Kong. So you guys should head on over to sockunion.com, and we'll have a link in the show notes, and you can show someone how much you care.
Great. Is the logo on the socks, is that familiar?
The striping is, the 64 is not, and there's no chicken head, which I suppose is okay. Because, you know, it's kind of questionable at the moment who owns the Commodore chicken head logo. So, one of those crazy things. But there's more stuff you can buy. If you don't want these striped Commodore socks, you can get, you know, a complete set of Battlestar Galactica. And with that, over to you, Michael. Tell us about eBay.
eBay, well, it's a wonderful place. You should buy things there.
but that's not important right now.
No, it's not. Just the continuing saga of packing up my house, I started boxing up my DVD collection. For the younger viewers out there, DVDs is what we had before we had streaming video. But this one is, one of my favorite shows in my favorite presentation box. So if you click on over to the wonderful world of eBay, we have here the entire original series on DVD in a Cylon helmet box set.
It looks like something like Infocom would have made. It's very cool.
Yes.
This is great.
Yeah. I just love it. I keep this one sort of like, forward facing in the computer / TV room where we currently are, but for a little while it's going to be carefully boxed up, and then it'll come back out again in all its shiny plastic chrome beauty.
So this one for sale at the moment isn't actually yours. You're keeping yours.
No, somebody else. No, I'm keeping mine. This is just one that I found. I thought that someone else out there should have one. So if you're a fan of the original Battlestar Galactica series, and who isn't? This one's not overly expensive, $44.95, not too bad. Buy it now.
Do really like that original series. It wasn't too long ago that my wife and I did a binge watch of this particular series. Just went through the whole thing like crazy fast. Yeah, that that Cylon mask is great. All right, so Carrington, you can't top Michael's thing. I wouldn't even try.
I'm not trying. But mine is an actual Infocom one, so there. But it's not a cool mom with a mask or so. It's a highly overpriced ballyhoo. But as listeners know, I do love a sealed piece of software. So I was a little tempted, but they want $230 for this thing. But it is a sealed, freshly sealed ballyhoo, too rich for my blood. But it's fairly rare that the Infocom Apple II games come up fully sealed onto eBay, so I thought I'd point out there's one there at the moment, but it's kind of dear. The sealed Apple II Infocom games, the regular ones, non-masks, not saucers, just your typical game like this Moon Mist, like the average ones, have been slowly pushing their way well past 100 towards 200, and now it seems they're looking for 230. They just keep going up and up and up. So much money.
Well, because you keep opening them.
Keeps being right. Fewer and fewer of them because of me. Well, I'm not opening up this one. I have already once played and reviewed this one. So too rich for my blood. But in case anybody else wants one, here is a sealed ballyhoo. So that's what I'm picking for my auction choice.
Great. And it does seem like, you know, getting them sealed does... one of the things about Infocom games is all the little feelies that you get with them. And you know that they'll be there. Mm-hmm. At least as long as it hasn't been resealed.
Yeah, for me, it's not so much about the disc. It's very easy to play Infocom games on anything, and including play them on an Apple II emulator if you want the actual Apple II version of them. It's much more about the feelies. Infocom games are one of the few that I do. I would argue that it is important to have the actual game, not just because the feelies can act as copy protection sometimes, but also just because that's a big part of the game itself. They are the graphics of the game in a sense, so... And Ballyhoo's a good one. Comes with a balloon and a ticket and stuff. So it's got some fun feelies in it.
Well, Paul, you have me on the edge of my seat here wondering which thing you're going to pick. You've got five different eBay things in the show notes. So is this like, you know, eBay roulette?
Yeah, I think I don't know. I was going to actually wait until you had done yours yet.
I'll go first then, so you can go ahead and pick. I found something. This just seems really exciting to me. It is a full ColecoVision Atom, and it's in nice shape. The person went to the effort of testing it, which, as you guys know, is a big thing with me. I like it when they actually make sure the computer works. And the starting price is $29, which I thought was extremely reasonable. And this thing looks mighty complete, and you can see screenshots of it in action. So here's the one downside. It doesn't come with a power supply. The person who's selling it had to jerry-rig it with a PC power supply or something like that to actually test it and make it work. So if you were to buy this, you would also then be on the hunt for a power supply that would power the thing. But assuming that you felt, well enough mechanically to design your own power supply or whatever, then you could get this working ColecoVision Coleco Expansion Atom Family Computer complete. Not sure what this will eventually close for. I usually pick auctions that are just listed. So this still has 6 days, 21 hours on it at the time of recording. There's a little bit of yellowing on the keyboard, the typical sort of thing that you expect with these beige-colored plastics as time goes on. But overall, I mean, you guys see these pictures? What do you guys think?
I like it. I like the fact that the printer's still working. I think it's important to note there's a difference between the Atom family computer and an Adams family computer.
Yeah, I saw that in the I saw that in the title and I clicked on and went, oh, it's a computer.
It's the ColecoVision.
But very nice one.
This one not quite as ghoulish as what Carrington was just describing.
But the printer works, which is cool.
Yes, the daisy wheel, mm-hmm. right? Weren't these a daisy wheel?
Was it?
I thought it was. I thought the Coleco came
looking
with
it. Looking at the zoom, it looks Daisy Wheely. It doesn't look like he's made of dots. I love a Daisy Wheel. Best type of printer ever.
The clackety-clack on those is just incredible. The ribbon on this looks like it's a little on the light side. Which
is old ribbons are easy to ink or replace, though. That's no big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So overall, I was really impressed with this. Great starting bid. So let's see what it eventually goes for. And now, Paul, have you had a chance to pick, or would you like us all to vote?
Go with the Kenbat one.
There isn't. I think the one I'm going to
He has everything but a Kenback one.
Yeah. Oh, that's because it's not the first personal computer.
So for the listeners who are not actually also looking at our internal show notes document, I couldn't make up my mind about what I wanted to pick on the there are many interesting things. The thing I think I'm going to actually talk about is the thing I probably don't know as much about, but
I was going to say, you couldn't make up your mind. There's half a dozen there.
Yeah. So There are always actually a few Heathkit, what are the ET3400s available on eBay. These are little microcomputer trainers. They're I think generally 6800 based, and they have a little keypad and they're in a nice blue case. The case actually cracks fairly easily, so it's you have to be sort of careful when you look at these. And I think I may have even mentioned before, this may have been a pick that I made on a previous show as well. The actual auction that I'm looking at here, though, has many of these little trainers. So it's not just a 3400, it's also a ET3100, 3200, 3300, which are all, you know, similar form factors, although I think the 3400 is the more sort of powerful of them. The other ones are various trainers of various kinds. But what is interesting about this, first of all, is that it seems to be coming with all of the manuals, so manuals for all of the things, all the nice orange, you know, Heathkit manuals. And the sort of most notable thing, I think, is that the 3400 has the memory I/O expansion kit, mm-hmm. which is incredibly, you know, impossible to find. The ETA 3400. Now I don't remember actually what it's. You know, it's, I think it probably provides, you know, like 8K or something like that. But it's as big as the thing itself. It sits underneath it with a kind of unpleasant looking wire that goes between the two. But it's a really interesting set to look at. And now it's expensive. They're asking for. It's expensive, but it's big. I can't decide. It might actually be appropriately priced, but
I think it is. It's a bunch of money, but I don't think $450 is an outrageous asking price.
I don't think it's outrageous at all. Ironically, I was actually going to showcase a Z80 based similar educational learning kit like this, but someone bought it before the show started, so I had to change my item. But no, I love this educational computer gadgets from their learning experience ones. It's just interesting to sort of see what was used back in those days compared to what the kids are learning with today.
You know, I got my electronics start on a Radio Shack 65 in one kit. I've talked to a number of other people who those science fair electronics kits were instrumental in their early technical development. And I bet that there is probably an equal number of people who started out with these Heathkit microprocessor trainers, and that jump started their career in the computer and electronics world. These things were really incredible, and I think this particular auction pick with the books and units that power up and I agree with the rest of you. I don't think $450 is out of line.
Yeah, I would love to have this. That memory module. There was another one that sold actually just like a day or two ago, and I don't remember what it went for, but it, just by itself, it was quite a lot. So a large proportion of the price could be, you know, considered to be for that module.
I'm actually surprised that this has had no bids.
Yeah, when does it close?
It's a pretty new auction actually. It closes in 6 hours.
Got to buy it now for $585, which is also not unreasonable. I'm surprised it's got a bunch of watchers and that no one stepped up to bid at all. Maybe everyone's waiting to snipe it at the last minute.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Doesn't ship to Canada, though, so whatever.
It's quite possible that this will end before the actual show airs, then. I did not realize quite how close it was to the end.
Teasing our listeners.
but look at the pictures, because they're really cool.
I bookmarked it. I'm going to come back later tonight and see if anyone did actually bid on this. And watch to see if it's relisted also. Very
and
cool.
See it,
very cool pick, Paul.
You're going to see who bought it and if their name rhymes with Earl.
Yes, that's right.
I was thinking it'll be Paul.
So, yeah, cool eBay picks too. And I'll probably check the rest of your links that you have on here, Paul, after the show is done. Paul has some of the best eBay foo of people that I've ever met. In the
sometimes I'll struggle to come up with one thing, and then I go to the show notes, and here's Paul's 10 choices. I mean, come on.
And they're all good choices, too.
Well, that explains why we can't find them. He's already gone and found them, and the foo has been removed.
Right.
There's a sort of constant level of foo.
We're no match. We're not worthy. All right, so closing discussions. We're going to go around the table, the round table, which is kind of squarish today with four of us. Michael, what have you got? I stole your... You had a closing thing on the show, and I...
Yes, I was going to do a shout-out for the VCF 2.0 for David, but we seem to have turned that into a what's happening in North America. Boy. I would really love to sort of come over for a couple of months and just go from one side of the States to the other, or going to all these different shows if it could possibly be teed up. But no, it's one of the few things that makes me insanely jealous of being over on the wrong side of the Pacific. Just all
you should
of
come
these.
To Kansas Fest. It's like middle of winter for you. You want to get away.
Winter? Oh, you mean where it drops down to about 10 degrees Celsius, yes. we don't know what cold means, but I believe that's right in the middle of your stinking hot, highly humid summer for Kansas City, isn't it?
Yep.
I think at Kansas Fest, it was, what was it, Carrington, about 175 degrees?
Million.
Outside. Yeah, about a million.
And about 200% humidity.
You don't really go outside much. You go outside to go between the buildings, like go get food and come back. And so you just bake for that short period.
So what, you actually have to step outside the air conditioning? Oh.
Only to go between the building that everybody stays in and presents in, and you have to walk across the quad to go to the building that has the calf. But really, that's it.
Right, and it's kind of a survival of the fittest sort of thing.
Yeah, I think one of these years I will have to come over to Kansas Fest. You're not the only ones that are saying that that I should go. Ken keeps harping on about it every year. No. Okay, so basically nothing else is really happening down in my 8-bit world, but Carrington.
I got a Ken back one. It's the first personal computer. I don't know if you've heard. Doesn't matter that the insides are basically wired rap nonsense, but whatever. First one. Yeah, sure. I look forward to revisiting that topic. For me, the big thing is Kansas Fest. Yes, I registered for Kansas Fest. I'm all set. Can't wait to go. It's usually the highlight or one of the highlights of my year, and I'm really looking forward to it. I haven't thought what I'm going to present, but I definitely want to present something. And this year, I think, is going to be the year that I try to do a Hackfest entry. Every year that I've gone previously, I haven't entered into Hackfest, and I'm starting to feel lazy about it. So I'm going to try to step up to the plate and do something for Hackfest. But I'm not sure what. But the good news is you can't do anything ahead of time anyway, so I really don't have to give it that much thought ahead.
If I could go, I'd want to win the tie contest this time, because that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, cool. I'm glad you're all signed up, and you know you're locked and loaded.
I am indeed. Cannot wait.
I would ask Steve if he had any parting shots, but unfortunately, Dr. Steve couldn't be on the show. So, you know, maybe he can email us and let us know what his parting shots are. And as for me, I'm taking a compiler's course, and it is just kicking my butt. This is a course through Coursera.org, and it's offered through Stanford online.
I've done a few of those Coursera courses. They're
Me too. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Coursera.
Let's put a link into Coursera into the show notes as well.
That's a great idea. We should do that. In fact, I'll type that right now. Oh, Carrington beat me to it.
I took a course on typing fast, so.
So this course is, as I point out, it's quite strenuous. And it's interesting because in my undergrad, I had a course on compilers, but things have changed and the theory has become more complex, but it's actually kind of fun. I mean, as you can imagine, the way you parse a computer language has some similarities to the way that you parse human language, but unlike human language, it's not riddled with ambiguities and imprecision. And
you should program it so that it does have that.
Yes, but then we'd have Skynet, and that would be a big problem, so I'm not going to do that. But what I do hope to do is use the knowledge once I'm through the course in contributing to the world of this cross-development, cross-compilation type of stuff. So building languages or compilers or that kind of thing that you use on the PC, but that target are retro computers of ye olde. And one of the interesting things that the instructor points out is that much of the essence of a compiler hasn't changed since the development of Fortran many, many moons ago, and that initial crack at a high-level language for computers. So I found that fascinating. The course actually started with a little run-through of the history of computer languages, so I thought that was great.
I highly recommend Coursera for our listeners. I've taken a bunch of things there. I did one of the courses on artificial vision, and it was amazing. So I can't see it at the moment. I'm sure it's still up there, but it was fantastic. A topic I had no real background in at all, but it was about linear programming and, you know, what's called belief propagation, which is message passing, and just sort of the thoughts and artificial intelligence and artificial vision in particular. And it blew my mind. It was like a 2-month course, and I loved it. So, yeah.
So cool. And they're free.
Yeah.
I mean, the beauty is, if you're a lifelong learner, and I mean, if you're listening to this show, you've already established that you're a genius.
Or you're stuck in the past, and it's time to learn some new things.
And in either case, so this is an either-or that takes you to Coursera.org, so go do it. And Paul, you get to close us out.
Yes, and my projects basically are just mounting without actual progress. But I'm looking forward to that's another little bit for the take a bit out of context. But at any rate, I have some time coming up this summer, and I think I'm going to try to make my way through some of these many, many projects that I have lined up. Also, one other thing from the corrections department that I should have mentioned is that taking part in that big A2 archaeology thing that I mentioned many minutes ago is also James Littlejohn. He wasn't posting in the Facebook thread, so I didn't.
I thought we had mentioned. Of course he is. Wow.
Yeah, I think I failed to mention his name, but he's playing a big part of this too.
You couldn't move the kind of stuff without James.
No.
James has historically been the guy with the big bus. That's how things get around in our community.
It is an incredible vehicle.
Yeah, and not alive at the moment, I think. I don't know if he's got it back up and going yet. But yeah, historically, large collections of Apple IIs cannot move from place to place in the country without James Littlejohn. So he is a very important part of the equation.
So yeah, watching the goings on that A2 archaeology stuff is going to be fun. That's going to be checking in on that on a daily basis. Well, cool. Well, thanks, you guys. That's it. We are in the spot in the show doc that we call final closing. And that has just a ring of finality that, yeah, I mean, we'll be back. It's just 2 weeks. But that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows, every single one of them, at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VCforum. And while you're there, I always mention this, you should go check out the other subforums that they have there, because that's where the cool stuff is going on in retro computer discussions. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And finally, we are a member of the Throwback Network, a proud member. And you can find the other proud members at throwbacknetwork.net. If you want retro and you want it now, that's where to go. And if you like the show, please write a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it, and it helps other people find us and that kind of thing. So cool. So until next time,
Retro Compute!
See you guys.